stories from the hot spots all over the world. For 19 years, we've promoted women's leadership and voices in international affairs, and I'm most appreciative that you're here today to support us in this mission. And can I tell you how weird it feels to be sitting here and not standing? Let me start by introducing my fellow board members. Elizabeth Hugh Miller, our moderator. Don Calabria, Maxine Isaacs, our former chair. Isabel Jasinowski, Marlene Johnson. Stand up and we'll applaud you at the end. Marlene Johnson, Teresa Lohr, Donna McLarty, Diana Negroponte, Mary Catherine Toker, and our president and fearless leader who helps us do so much, Patricia Ellis. I'd also like to introduce our Corporate Advisory Council members, CH2M Hill, Coca-Cola, General Mills, and ExxonMobil. If you all would stand and let us recognize you. And of course, I want to thank our generous contributors who are here with us. Our patron, Maxine Isaacs. I almost said patron saint, and she's that too. So Maxine Isaacs, our sponsor, the Embassy of the State of Qatar, and NAFSA, the Association of International Educators. Our supporter, Donna McLarty, and special friend, Elizabeth Stevens. Thank you so much. And a hearty welcome to the ambassadors, other diplomats, and government officials who are here with us. Also with us are, though, and I'd like the ambassadors to stand so that we can recognize them, are the ambassadors of Argentina, Greece, Liechtenstein, Oman, the Philippines, Ecuador, and Switzerland. And the Swiss ambassador is newly arrived, so a particularly hearty welcome to you. And all from the State Department are two assistant secretaries, Ambassador Ann Patterson and Roberta Jacobson. And I think Ann was... Ann's here! Right. Your support is critical to the success of our programs. You participate in so many programs and help us throughout the year, so thank you. And a special hat tip to Associate Director Kimberly Kahnheiser, who's usually standing in the back trying not to be recognized. She put together this program today and our programs throughout the year. And my final thank you goes to one of my favorite groups, the interns and volunteers. Believe me, they are the backbone of this program. So let's give these future leaders a hearty, hearty round of applause. It's been an outstanding year for the Women's Foreign Policy Group. We've done 40 major events with the organization that we have. We started our embassy series on a cold winter's night at the Embassy of Finland, and as the ambassador said, it was perfectly appropriate weather. It was starting to snow, and ended about 2 weeks ago at the Embassy of Japan. In between, we traveled the world with the ambassadors of Spain, Singapore, Mexico, Liechtenstein, Ireland, New Zealand, and Italy. Each ambassador hosted an evening of discussion and learning in their residence. And learn we did. We covered the world's hotspots: Africa, Afghanistan, Egypt, Iraq, Iran, Russia, and the Ukraine, Turkey, Syria, Roberta, Venezuela, you caused some news this year, some big news, and more. We discussed critical issues in depth. Ebola, and Helene, you hosted a panel for us that was just fabulous. Cybersecurity and refugees, to name a few. We celebrated women's leadership with National Security Advisor Susan Rice, with women diplomats and world-renowned journalists. We hosted briefings with government officials and convened a superb, superb book and author series. Next year, look at that, because there are some little hidden gems in there. But we consistently made sure that women's voices were heard in all areas of foreign policy. Most importantly, with the help of everyone in this room, we mentored the next generation of young women, over 500 of them. And I think that in itself deserves a big round of applause. Our next mentoring fair is February 4th at GW and February 26th at NYU in New York. Please join us. It's a wonderful night, and it's a good chance to give back, and plus, it's fun. It's a couple hours, probably 3 hours out of your life that you will forever be glad that you did. So we're ending the year in a very, very good spot, and again, thanks to all of you. Now, my advice for the holidays is rest up and put your running shoes on when you come back. And here's the reason. Next year is our 20th anniversary, and we intend to celebrate all year long with more excellent programming. So spread the word. Tell everybody you know what we're doing, and we will be hosting a women's leadership conference in June. For those of you who know us well, again, thank you for all that you do for us. And for those who are joining for the first time, please make sure that you come back soon. We look forward to welcoming you again. If you're not a member, join us today. There are cards on your table if you want to do a card, or at your convenience, go online and sign up. We'd love to have you be part of the Women's Foreign Policy Group. And if you're making contributions at year-end, please think of and put in the Women's Foreign Policy Group. We'd really appreciate that. Together, we can make a difference and ensure that women's voices are heard in all areas of foreign policy. One last reminder, there are cards on your table for questions for the panel. Please fill them out at whatever question you'd like to ask. Write legibly and include your name and affiliation. Again, thank you for joining us to honor women journalists who cover foreign policy and national security. And now, enjoy your lunch, and we'll be back shortly with the panel. Thank you very much.
Hey, everybody. silence. Okay, I hope you all enjoyed your lunch, and we're now about to begin our program. Here we have these wonderful panelists, all friends of mine, competitors at one point or another, colleagues. A lot of miles on this group, all over the world. So I'm going to introduce each of our panelists, and then I'm going to they're going to speak for 4 minutes about various topics they've been assigned to talk about and that they know about really well. And then I'm going to ask everybody one question, and then I'm going to open it up. Maybe two questions, we'll see. And then I'm going to open it up to you, so send your questions up. Our first speaker is Helene Cooper, Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times with those great shoes. And she, before this, Helene was the White House correspondent of the New York Times. Before that, she was the diplomatic correspondent covering Condé Rice all over the world. And before that, she was an assistant editorial page editor. She has reported from 64 countries. Prior to joining the Times, she worked for 12 years at the Wall Street Journal, where she was a foreign correspondent, a reporter, and an editor. She was born in Monrovia, Liberia, and is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The House at Sugar Beach, In Search of a Lost African Childhood. If you haven't read it, you really should read it. It is a fantastic book. It's a great page-turner, too. She's currently at work on a biography of the Liberian president, Helen Sirleaf Johnson. Our next speaker is Margaret Warner, the chief foreign affairs correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. She's also the lead correspondent for the NewsHour's overseas reporting unit, which has taken her to Afghanistan, Pakistan, Russia, China, Kenya, and Iran. That's just to name a few. Her coverage of the turmoil in Pakistan won her an Emmy Award in 2008. That same year, she also won the Edward Weintraub Prize for International Reporting at Georgetown. She's worked at Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, recently stepped down as a member of the Yale Corporation, is now very involved with the Jackson Institute at Yale. Next is Missy Ryan, who covers the Pentagon as part of the Washington Post National Security Team. Missy and I used to take a lot of trips together with various defense secretaries. She joined the Post earlier this year from Reuters. Before that, she was posted in Baghdad, where she was a correspondent and deputy bureau chief. She's also reported from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Egypt, Sudan, Yemen, Lebanon, and Libya, to name a few. She began her career working at an aid organization in Chile and as a journalist in Argentina and Peru. From 2012 to 2013, she took part in the White House Fellowship, which is a nonpartisan public service and leadership program. Finally, but not, we have Elise Labatt, CNN's global affairs correspondent. Elise has reported from more than 75 countries and has interviewed and traveled around the world with 5 secretaries of state. Most recently, she has reported extensively on the conflicts in Syria, Ukraine, and Israel. Since joining CNN in 2000, she has also reported on the Arab Spring uprisings, Pakistan's state of emergency in 2007, then Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's historic trip to Libya that same year, the war between Russia and Georgia, and the efforts of reconstruction teams in Afghanistan in 2010. Previously, she covered the United Nations for ABC. Okay, that is it. So, a lot of expertise here. So, Helene, why don't you start off? You're talking about Ebola, the transition at the Pentagon, and the Senate Intelligence Committee report.
Got it.
Did it for, yeah.
To start. 4 minutes.
Has the clock started? Thanks very much, Bea Miller. Bea Miller, she didn't mention that she's actually my boss when she was doing this whole we've all been colleagues thing. It's a pleasure to be here and on stage with this awesome group of colleagues and competitors. And thanks much to the Women's Foreign Policy Group for having me here. So each of the 4 of us have a specific area we're supposed to talk to you about, and I'm supposed to talk about Ebola, the firing of Chuck Hagel, and the torture report in 4 minutes. And I think I've already used up 3. So I'll talk really fast. The Ebola story is probably the one that's closest to my heart because I'm from Liberia and I've been watching this unfold over the course of this year. It's the worst pandemic to ever hit my home country, which has been through a lot to begin with, and it was a really tough one to cover. I was trying to think of what I could say today that would sort of leave you with something significant and raise issues also that we could discuss during the Q&A. And I think what I wanted to talk about on Ebola is just looking at the way the media has covered this story. I think there's been some fantastic standout coverage from really courageous journalists who have gone into these countries and who've done incredible work going into these treatment units at great peril and risk to themselves. And, you know, the Washington Post, the New York Times, NPR, the TV networks have all sent in people who have, you know, even afraid, been able to go in there and do this. But then I also think there's been some dreadful, dreadful coverage. And that's sort of the Ebola scare here, where we've gone, you've seen both, I think, the worst and the best of journalism. The hysterical coverage of Ebola, where the risk is practically non-existent here in the United States versus the really heroic coverage of Ebola, where the risk is huge in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and West Africa, and Guinea. And that, I think, has brought out both the best and the worst in journalism, but I also think it plays a lot into the fact that at the end of the day, we're all human beings. And, you know, sort of the hysteria of the Ebola coverage here taps into this basic human fight or flight instinct and this human fear that we all have. And I think we really saw that this year with the coverage of Ebola. I was in Liberia for a few weeks in September and October covering Ebola. It's probably one of the hardest stories I've ever covered. And in part because this is such a horrible, horrible disease that immediately makes pariahs out of the victims. You know, if you're covering a hurricane or a tornado or some horrible natural disaster, and you know, the victims, you're going there to help. But if you're covering Ebola, the minute somebody comes down with it, they're immediately, you know, a pariah. And you have to imagine a family member being told that the only way they're going to survive is if they don't pick up their crying baby or, you know, dying mother who has Ebola. And it's such a horrible, horrible thing to have to say to any kind of human being. And that was one of the things I really had to grapple with getting, you know, sort of getting that across. This whole idea that the second you become sick, you then become a pariah and people are immediately asking questions about what stupid thing did they do that they got it. And, you know, you're basically left to die on your own. I came back from Liberia. I've way obviously used up like 5 minutes already. I came back from Liberia and then did a voluntary 3-week quarantine. And I just only mentioned that because Elise Labatt and Bue Miller, Elise sent me a care package of chocolate and cheese.
Nice.
And Bue Miller sent me wine. And so I think I gained like 10 pounds while I was like quarantining. And then Chuck Hagel got fired. Which was going from covering Ebola to like this quintessential Washington story, which has been sort of the story of this Obama administration, and Chuck Hagel's firing kind of encapsulates that of a cabinet secretary who's kind of kept on the outside from the White House inner circle and never quite allowed in, and sort of when after the midterms when they're looking for somebody to cut loose, he was kind of the low-hanging fruit. That doesn't say there weren't issues with Chuck Hagel, because I think he had a lot of problems articulating a clear administration strategy, but whether or not that was because we didn't have a coherent strategy or whether he couldn't do it, I'll leave that up to you guys to decide. But it was a really interesting Washington story. This is something that has happened to President Obama time and time again, where he's had brought in these big name outsiders and then they haven't really got along or haven't found a way to penetrate his core White House inner circle. And so now we're looking at the fourth defense secretary to come in the Obama term, Ash Carter. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how Ash Carter gets along with Susan Rice. My time is up, which means I can't talk about the torture report, but we just had lunch anyway, so there's no need to go into rectal meetings.
Yes, I'm only assigned two topics, which is ISIS and Ukraine, and these are both, of course, topics that the new Defense Secretary, Ash Carter, is going to have to deal with. But, you know, ISIS, picking up on your theme, Helene, of, by the way, I think the bravest kind of coverage is to go to an Ebola zone, seriously. For all of us who go cover wars, to go to a place in which the enemy and the danger is unseen, and you personally could be at risk in a way where you can take precautions, but it's not the same as you can in a war zone. I just want to say that. I said it to you at lunch, but I just want to say that. Really gutsy. Really, really gutsy. But ISIS, definitely, you know, that is the big story. That is the big issue that the new Secretary of Defense is going to have to deal with in military terms. And after not paying attention to what was going on in Iraq, really, ever since, really, 2010, but certainly 2011, when we pulled all American forces out of there, it came as a shock to the American administration that some members of Saddam Hussein's former, you know, Ba'athist commanders and other members of Zarqawi's, you know, al-Qaeda in Iraq had seen an opportunity in this ungoverned space in eastern Syria, had moved over there, had established, they're very effective fighters, they really know what they're doing, and had made common cause with some of the most jihadi elements there. And so all of a sudden in June, as you all know, ISIS rolls over a third of Iraq. And suddenly the United States is faced with having to defend both Erbil, Iraqi Kurdistan, which was being emptied out, people were so scared, as well as all of Baghdad at the very least. So belatedly the U.S. has gotten involved, and I was there in this time in Iraqi Kurdistan, where I'd never visited before because I thought it was so calm. And, you know, it's everything from being along the ISIS front lines and seeing how very close it is and how much of a threat it is to Iraq's economy, for example. I mean, that highway you used to be able to drive from Erbil to Baghdad, you now have to make a sharp left over a bunch of rocks because the ISIS flags are literally, you know, as far as that mirror. I mean, they're right over there. And being in an armored car helps, and being with the military helps. But still, you could see how people are feeling extremely afraid. But this, again, the most touching and heart-rending parts of this kind of coverage is talking to people who've been driven from their homes. And whether it was right around Erbil and they've been driven out of certain parts of Iraq, not or going way up to the, I always get my northwest portion where Syria, Iraq, and Iraqi Kurdistan all come together. So it'd be like over here for you all, where all these Yazidis had fled and spending a day with them. To have mothers say to you, I wish I were dead. I wish I'd stayed and let my Sunni neighbors kill me. That is really something. I met a pregnant woman living in, which is where a lot of these people are living. They're unformed or unfinished buildings. So they're all concrete, but they have no fronts. And whole, you know, 300, 400, 500 people from a particular village. These were a lot from around Mosul were living there. This woman was 7 months pregnant. She couldn't even get care because even though she's an Iraqi, she had fled without any of her papers, any of her documents. So she's one of those undocumented people. So the human stories are really wrenching, and there's sort of nothing you could do. You can hand out all the water you want, but, I mean, these people are really, really desperate. I think the problem, just very quickly, analytically, is what we've got, what the administration's got is against ISIS, is they call it an Iraq-first strategy. I think there are a lot of, I know there are a lot of high-level people in the administration who think it's an Iraq-only strategy. That is, militarily, all it is try to roll ISIS back out of Iraq first, then deal with Syria. But in Syria, there is no, you know, there's, the United States is unwilling to take on getting rid of Assad as a military goal. There is a feeling that there is no either political leadership that's well respected by all anti-Assad forces, nor really in this Free Syrian Army that we sort of help stand up, but not really. So they're going to have to create a whole new set of fighting forces. Their timeline is like a year and a half from now. There's no place for them to go. A very senior military official said to me just last week, we are essentially, the space for Syrian moderates has shrunk to almost nothing. So there's the big debate, as everybody on this panel knows, with the Turks, who are very willing to help, very willing to let their bases be used for assault operations by us and our NATO allies, if we will help create some sort of safe haven. So we can save the rest of that for questions. Because quickly on Ukraine, I'd just like to say that I think, press-wise, not enough attention has been given to Ukraine. I think that what Putin has already done in Ukraine, and no one knows what he's going to do next, really threatens the whole stability of the post-Cold War order that George H.W. Bush liked to talk about it. And this sort of sense that countries don't violate the borders of other countries. And that it was on that basis that all these Eastern European countries had, they had to settle all their border disputes and all their ethnic disputes to join the EU and particularly NATO. It really created a kind of zone of our own allies that we could count on. That is now all coming unglued. I mean, if you talk to the Poles or the Latvians, Lithuanians, and Estonians, they're not even sure NATO will defend them. And so I think that there's a kind of challenge there that it really threatens a sort of tenet of the international rules, and I'm going to stop right there.
All right, great. Well, thanks for being here today. It's a real pleasure. I'm going to just make some very brief remarks focused around a trip that I just got back from, which was Secretary of Defense Hagel's final trip overseas and sort of his swan song and a chance for him to say goodbye to the troops serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then I'll make one brief comment about Libya, which I feel like is sort of an underappreciated challenge at the moment. So first of all, Chuck Hagel stopped off in Afghanistan, and as everybody here knows, the United States is ending combat operations after over 13 years of fighting the Taliban, and it's gone down from a peak force, U.S. force, of 100,000 in 2010, 2011, to just 10,000 today. At the same time, the NATO force is withdrawing, but the Taliban is also continuing its insurgency, and in fact, there's been a spike of attacks in Kabul, and as we have a former ambassador to Pakistan here, as everyone knows, the situation in Pakistan has not changed the extent where there's a belief that the safe havens that have enabled the Taliban to launch attacks into Afghanistan during the entire year, they're still around. And that poses a problem. We're thinking about what the Afghan security forces will be able to do in 2015 and beyond. And I think in that context, what's interesting to note is that the U.S. military appears to be trying to maximize the wiggle room that it has within the constraints and the withdrawal plan that was established by President Obama. And so I think that that's why in the past couple weeks we've seen a decision to expand the combat authorities for the remaining U.S. force. And that's something that the Times has done some great reporting on. And there also was a decision actually while it was on this trip an announcement from Secretary Hagel that there would be a larger than previously anticipated force in Afghanistan in 2015, and it was only 1,000 troops, which doesn't seem like a big deal, but I think it's an indicator of how difficult it is to actually end this war. And there's sort of a confrontation between the narrative that the administration has of drawing down in Afghanistan and ending the war after over 13 years, and the reality of a conflict that is continuing, just as it continued in Iraq after we left in 2011. So after Afghanistan, we also visited Iraq, and obviously that visit was focused around the Islamic State. And the United States is sort of deja vu in Iraq at this point. We're expanding the military footprint in Iraq. It's about 1,650 right now in terms of American troops on the ground, and that could increase to about 3,000 in the near term. And the troops right now are limited to a non-combat role. They're advising. They're now going to be training a sort of leaner, meaner Iraqi army. But all of this will take time to really make sure that the Iraqi forces are able to take on the Islamic State. While I was on the trip, I also got to tag along on some meetings that Secretary Hagel had with Iraq's new national unity government. And the message was pretty clear from them, which is that they are appreciative of what they've gotten so far from their renewed American military involvement in Iraq, but that they want more. They want more air power. They want more heavy weaponry. And I think it remains to be seen how much more the Obama administration and Congress will be willing to support. And I think in Iraq, as in Syria, the administration is trying to walk this fine line. You know, everybody wants to stave off the total catastrophe that, you know, a jihadi takeover of such a strategic country in the Middle East would be. At the same time, I think there's a very deep desire to avoid becoming embroiled in another messy conflict in the Middle East. And finally, I'll just mention Libya. And it's hard to overstate the chaos and instability that is gripping Libya, and it's been about 3.5 years since the revolution there began. There's two governments in Libya right now. There's the internationally recognized government that is ruling out of Tobruk. They were actually kicked out of the capital, Tripoli. And there's a parallel government supported by Islamist militia in the capital, Tripoli. In addition to that, there's various armed factions and militias all across the country. All of this has impaired oil production. It's paralyzed the economy. And the security situation is just terrible. And I think that, to me, this is the top underappreciated threat in the region. And it doesn't seem, at this point in time, that there are direct American interests being threatened. But I think that this is the one that we're going to look back in a couple of years and say, you know, why didn't we try harder to do more to make sure that the collapse of Libya that is occurring doesn't continue?
Thank you, and thanks to the Women's Foreign Policy Group and Elizabeth and everybody for being here. And it's a pleasure to be on this panel with four women that I respect so much and have been competitors and traveling companions and friends whose work I really admire a lot. All of the women touched upon foreign policy issues that are on Secretary Kerry's plate right now. And I think one of the issues that we've seen different from Secretary Kerry than Secretary Clinton is his desire to kind of dive right in and be seen as the person driving a lot of these issues. So whether it's on ISIS, he's trying to build a global coalition, or whether it's on Ukraine, he's flying off to meet with Foreign Minister Lavrov. And I think a lot of times, you know, while there was a criticism of Secretary of State Clinton that she didn't want to get her hands really dirty, you know, Secretary Kerry does want to get his hands dirty, get into the sandbox, but a lot of people have criticized that they're not really sure what he's making out of that, and does all this travel, and you see he's on the road all of the time. Is he confusing, you know, movement in the skies and movement from capital to capital with forward movement? And are we seeing results? And on some issues, we're seeing results. We saw a agreement with the Russians on chemical weapons. We do see a global coalition on ISIS. We see a lot of things. But I think one of the questions where it's so evident on this question of whether the Secretary's desire for this personal hands-on diplomacy is really productive is in the Middle East peace process. You know, Secretary Kerry came to office with, you know, a single sales objective, really, which was to solve the Middle East peace process. And some people said, oh, he just wants a Nobel Peace Prize, but I really do believe that, you know, he feels and he hears from his, you know, allies as he travels around the world that this is a conflict between Israeli-Palestinian is one of the main things that's really holding up the region from flourishing and developing and reaching its true potential and is the source of all the extremism. I might beg to differ on that, but that is where his heart is. And he spent the first, you know, I'd say year and a half really trying to bring the parties together for to get some kind of framework agreement. There was some progress in the sense that through all these talks, the parties' positions became much clearer what exactly those parties were looking for. But it's a double-edged sword because the more evident those positions became, the more evident it also became that they're very far apart. These parties, despite years and years of talking, are very far apart. And so by April, when the deadline was drawing to a close, then became the recriminations. I think the U.S., you know, pretty much laid down the gauntlet blaming Israel a lot more because of the settlement activity, because of Prime Minister Netanyahu's, what they saw as intransigence on his part, his not making good on his promises. But I think also the Palestinians didn't really come to the table ready to make those compromises. And I also think that the parties were humoring Secretary Kerry for a good part of the time. I mean, they thought that they saw he was determined. They respected his efforts. And also they didn't want to be seen as the one kind of, as we say, with the dead cat on their porch. They didn't want to be seen as the ones who broke down the peace process. You know, and some people say when there's a peace process, this is good because even if there's no deal, it stops there from being a lot of violence. And we did see during that year and a half that there was relatively little violence. And when the peace process broke down, you have seen since that time a lot of violence increasing. Since June, we saw the Israeli teenagers kidnapped. We saw the war in Gaza and a spate of violence between Israelis and Palestinians. This stabbing in a synagogue. So a lot of people feel that did Kerry's efforts bring this peace process backward? It certainly doesn't look very good right now. We have a really rocky period ahead. Israeli elections are coming on, and you're facing a lot of action on the international stage. Prime Minister Netanyahu has called for early elections, but you also have the Palestinians looking to go to the United Nations for some kind of action. And you also have a lot of European nations very frustrated with Israeli settlement activity, the lack of a deal. They're recognizing a Palestinian state. There's going to be a movement at the United Nations for a UN Security Council resolution that puts down a framework agreement. And Secretary Kerry is in Rome right now, another meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu trying to calm the tensions. But I do feel that the U.S. is in for a period where, you know, they're also frustrated. And, you know, when you see all these international efforts going on, usually the U.S. is the first to pick up the phone and call the French, call the British, say, listen, you know, this is not helpful. Really go 150% in terms of offering this unequivocal political support for Israel. I don't think we can count on that anymore. Obviously, where Israel's security is concerned, I think that the U.S., you know, that's very sacrosanct. But in terms of political support at the U.N. and elsewhere, I don't think it's going to be the kind of 100%, 50% that we saw in it. And as everyone was saying, we forget that these are people who are just looking to live side by side. When you get the recriminations on both sides, you forget that these are people who are looking for peace and security and the right to self-determination. I'll just talk briefly about Iran. We're coming off that extension of Iran talks on a nuclear deal. When the parties came to that final round of talks, it was already pretty evident that there was not going to be a deal, that the parties were just too far apart. The positions were just, you know, too set in stone. Diplomats say there was progress. Iran did come with ideas, but not enough. Not enough progress. So the main sticking points remain, which is really around the pace and scope of the lifting of sanctions and how much Iran's nuclear program, particularly its uranium enrichment program, it's able to keep. You know, the Iranians are talking about magic numbers. Oh, we can reach this magic number. But the U.S. is not, and its partners in the so-called P5 plus one are not really so romantic about all of this. They say this comes to cold, hard math. How can you stave off Iran from that, what we call this breakout capacity to develop a nuclear weapon? Some people say it's as little as 3 months right now. The international community is looking to prolong that for about a year. And the Iranians kind of want to meet the international community in the middle, like halfway, like you say this, we say this, let's meet in the middle. But diplomats would say, no, you're the one who violated the international obligations. You need to do what we want to do. And so the question, I think, on the table is not whether they can arrive at some magic number. It's whether the Iranians are ready to make that strategic choice to curb their nuclear program. Yes, they want to stave off sanctions. There could probably be a deal to do that. But unless they are ready to make that strategic choice to end it, I don't really think anybody's really optimistic about a deal. And then lastly, will an Iranian nuclear deal lead to greater cooperation with the U.S. and others on ISIS, on the Syrian civil war? I would argue no. Iran, you see Iran taking some actions against ISIS. That's because ISIS is a threat to them, and that's in their own interest. But you've seen the supreme leader, you know, pretty much, you know, put down U.S. overtures for greater cooperation with that letter from President Obama and overtures from Secretary of State Kerry. And that's because there is a debate in Iran right now between the moderates, such as President Rouhani, and Foreign Minister Zarif, who feel that Iran's future is moving towards opening up cooperation with the West and a rapprochement, and hardliners who see that opening up is a threat to the survival of the regime. So with that, I think we can open
okay.
it up for lots of questions.
Thank you all. So I'm going to do just one question each and then open up to the crowd. Helene, the torture report.
So can't get away from it, Helene.
Got it. Why did Obama walk such a careful line in his response? The White House said torture was terrible, but they wouldn't answer the question that does torture not work? They wouldn't agree with that. So what was the reason for the very careful line?
Because at the end of the day, you just saw President Obama and in some ways his CIA director, John Brennan, really trying to thread this needle. You know, the last thing, just think about what it would look like if they threw the CIA under a bus at this point. You know, President Obama is well aware that he still really needs the CIA. He's very, you know, these are guys who took direction from higher ups, and it would just, I think you're talking about morale problems there. There's also the issue that there's so many people at the CIA who were not on board with this. It's not as if the CIA is some monolith. It's not. There was a lot, you had a lot of pushback as well. And so at the end of the day, you see this torture report coming out, and you just saw President Obama really sort of distancing himself, even though I thought the John Brennan press conference last week was a spectacular sort of televised event to see how far he's come. Well, some of us were joking that he looked like he'd been turned. The guy who's like, so I thought that was really interesting. And I just think that the administration reaction versus you see Brennan there's talking about a partisan, a guy who was appointed by a Democratic president talking about this partisan report that, you know, we've had enough disclosure on it. It was just really interesting to watch.
Margaret. What is the real reason the administration will not go after Assad?
Well, one, the president doesn't want to get involved in another war, as many of us have said. And second,
beyond that.
But beyond that, I think that there is a understanding that you've also got this whole new Cold War going on in the Middle East between Tehran and the Saudis, and that if you start going after Assad, the anti-ISIS coalition may even fracture. There are people, certainly Iran and Russia, still support Assad. Now, there's a debate about whether they're wedded to Assad versus the Assad regime. And the administration is now currently looking at, could you really send a message, though I think they've been doing this for 2 years, to Alawites in the high command there, people in the government, that in fact We're not talking about getting rid of all of you. We're not going to make the same mistake Paul Bremer made in Iraq. We understand you can make the country run. You just got to get rid of, help us get rid of this guy. There is a discussion about that. But there's a recognition that the U.S. still needs Iranian and Russian support for a lot of other plates on the table. Meanwhile, the Saudis, of course, are incredibly upset that you were dealing with Iran on the nuclear arms talks. They very much want to get rid of Assad, and so do many of the Gulf states. So it's just geopolitically incredibly complicated, and finally, it's not at all clear how you get rid of him.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Missy, two quick questions. Not hard. You're not going to be able to answer, but one of them is easy. One is, to what extent is what happened in Iraq and the fact that we're building up again in Iraq driving decision-making about military size of the military force in Afghanistan, the U.S. force? To what extent are there lessons learned from Iraq driving policy in American policy in Afghanistan? And the second question is, what does Afghanistan look like in 10 years? That's one you can't answer.
Okay, on the first question, I mean, I think that very clearly you see a worry within the U.S. military about this sort of drop-off period that we're entering in 2015, the end of combat operations. You're having this small residual force that actually goes on a pretty swift timeline from about 10,000 American troops at the beginning of 2015 to a military force of zero at the end of 2016. And I think there are a lot of people who, within the U.S. military, who felt very uncomfortable with the way things happened in 2011 when there was an effort and a plan originally to keep a residual force in Iraq. It didn't happen for reasons on both sides, for political reasons in Iraq and then political reasons here in the United States. And so I think that it's very much driving this questioning that's happening about, okay, what's a safe way to do this within the parameters that have been set by the president. And the American commander in Afghanistan, General Campbell, is pretty clearly suggesting that he may ask for some sort of slowing of the timeline for departing Afghanistan and potentially keeping a residual force there larger for longer. And on the second question, what does Afghanistan look like in 10 years? Let me just consult my crystal ball. But I think that, Afghanistan has been in a state of some sort of civil war, civil conflict for at least 30 years, and I don't think there's any reason to think that this is going to end now. All of the drivers of the conflict remain, as I said before, the safe havens in Pakistan, the proxy war between, India and Pakistan within Afghanistan, and then the just sort of poverty and sort of regional factions and competition that happens within Afghanistan. I think that, there are some things that I would hope cannot be rolled back, such as, the important rights and protections that have been gained for Afghan women over the last 13 years, and the increase in life expectancy. I think it went from something like 50 years at the time of the, American and NATO invasion in 2001 to like 63 in the course of 13 years, which is pretty amazing. So hopefully those gains can be protected. But I think it's a pretty safe bet that there's going to be some degree of ongoing insurgency there for the next decade.
Okay, and Elise, what you talked about the difference in the two sides in the Iran potential deal. What possibly could a deal look like? That would everybody would agree to.
Well, I think that a deal would preserve. Anybody that says that Iran is going to walk away from this deal without some kind of enrichment capacity, I think is fooling themselves. Iran is not going to sign a deal that doesn't give them some kind of face-saving, and even more than that, a significant enrichment program. The question really is, can they come up with a number? So I say a deal looks like this. Iran ships out a majority of its already enriched uranium stockpile, which is considerable, to Russia, where Russia would kind of reprocess it. We won't get too technical about it, but they'll do some. They'll reprocess it and send it back to Iran for nuclear use. Iran is going to have to either get rid of, but more likely dismantle and make ineffective. It's some 19,000 centrifuges so that it cannot enrich any further uranium. There's an Iraq heavy water plant that produces plutonium. Iran would need to make that ineffective, disable it. And then there would need to be some pretty heavy spot inspections by the international community, whereas one of the concerns is that Iran is not able to develop a military program, and that's one of the military dimension to its nuclear program, and that's one of the aspects that Iran has not been able to deal with yet. So that question isn't necessarily on the table right now, but they're going to have to come up with something with the IAEA, and then the sanctions are going to have to be lifted. In order for this deal to work, Iran needs to get something out of it. And so that sanctions are going to need to be lifted. And the question is, what is the pace and scope according to what Iran is already able to do? And then the question is, how long is this deal for? So Iran is balking at the idea that it could be for 10 years. But then after 10 years, you're right back to where you are again. So I don't think that this deal is going to permanently deal with the Iranian question. I think it's just going to kick the can down the road, as we say.
Okay, now, thank you. I've now got questions from the audience. Here's two that are similar for Helene. The first one is, how does Secretary Kerry and Susan Rice get along? The second one is, was Ash Carter eager to take the DOD job? Do you think he realizes the difficulty of getting his point of view across if it contradicts Susan Rice of the NSC?
Will you ask for this, Helene?
The first question, I'd love to defer that to Elise, but I'll take a whack at it. There's been a lot of discord within the national security community at the White House, and what they call their vaunted interagency process. We have some assistant secretaries of state here. I would love to have them take a whack at this. Without saying anything about whether John Kerry and Susan Rice get along with each other, I have not spoken with either of the two of them about the other. I have, however, spoken to lots of people within the administration, both on the NSC side, the State Department side, and the Pentagon side. And I can tell you that there is certainly a belief outside of the NSC, and even within the NSC, that the process there is very, very difficult. It's dysfunctional, and that, there's not necessarily a lot of love lost between Ms. Rice and her cabinet secretaries. Ash Carter definitely wanted this job. This is a job that he's wanted, I think, for a long time. He wanted the Hagel job 2 years ago, and he was passed over for it. He is, for many, many reasons, there are a lot of reasons why, for a career defense specialist like Ash Carter, this is, a great job, because you don't get too many shots at Secretary of Defense. A lot of people will say that there are only 2 years left in the administration, why would anybody take this job? But for somebody who's come in through the Pentagon, Ash Carter practically grew up at the Pentagon. This is, sort of the ultimate. So, and I think, I don't think he's going to be a pushover. I don't think he is somebody who is going to roll over. It was really cool during his nomination ceremony. He's standing there. Hagel didn't show up at the ceremony. But Obama, said nice things about him. And then afterwards, when they're all milling, talking to people in the crowd, Ash Carter goes straight up to Susan Rice, and the two of them do this big, huge bear hug for like 10 seconds. I was counting it, and it was just sort of amazing to watch. You're like, wow, this is going to be really interesting. He's very, very smart, and he's very, I think he's very secure and confident in his own opinions and in his view of what should be done, in a way that Chuck Hagel was not seen as being necessarily that assured. So I don't think he's gonna, if the White House was hoping that they were gonna get somebody who would roll over and play dead, I think they're in for a surprise.
That's right. The only thing I'd add to that, which excellent and personal, is that what you've really seen is this tremendous growth in the power, in the size and power of the NSC. in the Obama administration, and it really started under Jim Jones when Tom Donilon was his deputy. But speaking to someone on the who works for the Director of National Intelligence, I'll leave it at that, who has returned to the administration at a very senior level, he said it's stunning the difference. We used to deal mostly with the secretaries and assistant secretaries of state and defense. And he said now we spend most of our time dealing with the directors of Middle East or whatever it is. And so that is sort of the big picture, and I don't know if anyone, it's gone from something like 30 professionals to they've still got, now got some 600 people at the NSC. So it's like a mini foreign policy and defense operation.
I'll just quickly say, don't forget that, you know, Susan Rice wanted this job as Secretary of State, and, you know, with the whole Benghazi issue, it kind of fell through her hands. And so I think John Kerry wanted this job for his whole life, and now that he's got it, he does not want to be, you know, kind of dictated to by Susan Rice. And, you know, there is no love lost there. And he barely listens to anything the White House says anyway. So I don't really think that, he's listening to Rice. But what I will say in line with what Helene and Margaret are saying is you also saw stories about Secretary Kerry and that he was out of favor with the administration and how Hagel was in out of the administration. And I think what the White House was doing in many ways was trying to deflect from the problem, that the problem is at the White House. The problem is within the NSC process, and there isn't anybody in any other agency that will tell you otherwise. And I think, you know, there are questions about whether, as Helene said, whether Secretary Hagel was the right man for the job and whether he was up to the task and able to articulate a thoughtful strategy for the Defense Department. But if this administration thinks that getting rid of Secretary Hagel or you know, kind of bashing Secretary Kerry behind his back, which I think is, you know, this is not me talking from a State Department effect, but I just think is unprofessional and supremely unfair, given that he's carrying a lot of water for this administration. I think they're fooling themselves if that's going to cure the ills of this administration's foreign policy. The problem is that this president is relying on a very small coterie of aides, not really paying attention to what his cabinet secretaries and commanders in the field are telling him, and that's where the problem lies. It's not with Secretary Kerry or Secretary Hagel. It's at the White House.
Okay, I got a question for you, too. Sort of Eastern European questions. What more can the U.S. do to protect Ukraine from dismantlement by Putin? And for history, was it a mistake to encourage former communist bloc Eastern European countries to join NATO?
Well, those are two pretty hefty ones, and I really, in the interest of time, I've buzzed over Ukraine in one sense. I mean, there are two fronts. There's the fighting front in the east, which the U.N. said today, now 4,500 people have been killed, 1,300 just since the ceasefire. But the real issue is in Kiev itself. And this new government, is it really ready to make, I mean, it's in desperate financial shape. And so the U.S. has been giving non-lethal aid. You know, a national security official in Ukraine told me a month or two ago, you know, only two-thirds of our guys even have bulletproof vests. I mean, it's pathetic. Now there is a move afoot to up that, to give some sort of lethal assistance, but the U.S. is still highly reluctant to give true military, offensive military, or even aggressive defensive military equipment. So nobody knows what Putin's intent is. In other words, there are two theories. One is he just wants to create this frozen conflict so that Ukraine is never attractive enough for the EU to join the EU because it'll have these unresolved conflicts. And so he's already accomplished that. The other is he wants to establish a land bridge all the way from Russia down along the coast to Crimea, because Crimea is just like dying on the vine, and we're going into winter and it's going to be very tough to get supplies across. So nobody knows, and anyone who says they know, there are many theories. The second one was
it a mistake to have?
That is a roiling debate. did the U.S. kind of get a little too porky, a little too full of itself in NATO that during the Yeltsin years, which were so tempestuous in Russia, and in which Russia was so weak, to go ahead and allow all these, not only former Eastern European countries, which after all had been countries like Poland and Hungary, but former republics like the three Baltics, into take it, the border of NATO right up to the Russian border. And you hear Putin talk about this he thinks so. I mean, history will never know. I mean, we will never know from history. It will remain one of those conundrums. And, you know, you'll have a Zbigniew Brzezinski on one side and plenty of other people on the other. And I'll leave it at that, because, I mean, I can't say. I was heavily involved covering that because I was the diplomatic correspondent at Newsweek. But the feeling was Russia was fine with this. They never raised a peep. And, you know, Putin saying, yeah, well, that was the wrong Russian you were talking to.
Well, let me ask this of Misty, but I want all you to jump in. The question is, when has your gender been an advantage as you cover global issues? I would also ask, when's it been a disadvantage? And I think I'd ask you because of all the military
coverage. Yeah, I think that, in my experience, it's been an advantage in certain situations that may not be obvious, like reporting in Afghanistan, for example. As a woman, often you have access to people you can interview that you wouldn't have if you were a man. For example, I could go in and interview, you know, if there's somebody in a village, I could interview the wife and the family and the, you know, women who are sort of in a different part of the house. And a male reporter wouldn't be able to do that, it's sort of a weird situation as a Western reporter, female reporter in a place like Afghanistan or a country like Yemen, where it's often unclear at what times do the local gender norms apply to you and which they don't. But I certainly have found it to be an advantage in that kind of situation. The obvious disadvantage, I don't think it has come up for me so much, like in doing embeds with the military or anything like that. I just think the disadvantage is sometimes the feeling of vulnerability that you have if you're out and covering protests, or the perception that you might be more vulnerable as a female reporter in a conflict zone or a place where there's lots of protests going on because of the possibility of sexual assault, which of course doesn't only happen to women. But I think there's a perception that women can be more vulnerable to that, and so that sort of feeds this sense of risk that we have. But, you know, it's something that I think that, you know, we keep in mind and try to train and be aware of, and there's only so much you can do, of course.
Anybody else before I ask the last question?
I'll just quickly give an example of where it's been. I think largely it's been an advantage because of the reasons that Missy says, and also because a lot of times men feel like, oh, they're just talking to some young woman, and they don't really know what they're saying, and next thing you know, you're like, thank you very much. One area where it worked at a disadvantage was in Israel when I was covering story of the religious and what their role with the army would be. And I went into a yeshiva, and I interviewed a rabbi, and he kept, you know, going like this and going like this, and this is all on camera. And I, you know, he wouldn't even, like, look at me in the eye. And I thought maybe he had a, you know, disability or a handicap or something. And I said to my cameraman, I said, was that weird, you know? And he said, you know, no, you're a woman. And he doesn't want to look at you because the religious in Israel. And so there is like a segregation in some areas. I experienced it in Israel. I experienced it in Libya where they try to segregate the men and the women. But I find largely that's not a huge issue.
I think summed it up.
Yeah. Okay. Last question. What will be President Obama's foreign policy legacy?
Oh, I'm sorry.
The White House thinks that the biggest thing that they really want the Iran deal. But I think that's what, if you ask the White House, you know, what are the big things that you think that you will have gotten? They will say Iran. And they believe that they can get it. Beyond that, speaking just, you know, as somebody from the peanut gallery, I don't know the answer to that. I think in many ways, the Obama administration is going to be, if you're measuring it against Bush the George W. Bush administration, I certainly don't think you're going to, if you look at the sort of the Hippocratic oath of first do no harm, I don't think you're going to be seeing, because of President Obama, a lot of the things that we see now are happening in the world that people point to that may not have happened if President Bush had not gone into Iraq. I don't think you're going to see that sort of thing coming out of Obama, but I also don't think you're going to necessarily see that huge, anybody's a great narrative coming out that lays out a coherent foreign policy path that this president put put the country toward. It's much more about minimizing the risk for the United States and kind of not necessarily leaving it in a worse place than he found it.
And picking up on that, I would say that the other two things, of course, that President Obama promised when he ran for office, he wanted to get us cleanly out of Iraq. And then he said he had to shift focus to Afghanistan, but get us cleanly out of Afghanistan, and neither of those will be true. And I think the criticism of President Obama's administration or of him will be that he, in trying to do no harm and to extricate the United States from being an occupying power, and I do think that will be a lasting legacy. I think Bob Gates said it first, the former Secretary of Defense, when he said any defense secretary recommends to an American president that we should do another land war occupation in Asia should have his head examined. He, of course, being a Republican. But President Obama, I think, has made clear that, as far as he's concerned, is not going to be U.S. policy. But what we haven't seen from him is what replaces that. And, in fact, the two things that he hoped he would be able to point to, he's not going to be able to point to. They're both going to be left as messy conflicts for the next person to solve.
I think on the military front, what I see as a really important component of the legacy will be this shift from, as you all were saying, these large on-the-ground nation-building counterinsurgency slash occupations that we had in Iraq and Afghanistan to this new model, which is largely a focus on sort of this new counterterrorism partnership where it's a very small number of troops involved with supporting foreign forces, foreign special forces, to help them combat their own counterterrorism or militant problems at home, combined with the heavy use of drones and occasional U.S. special forces raids. And that's sort of at the very other end of the spectrum. And I think it's important to note that we haven't really been able to take stock yet of what the long-term and medium-term consequences of that will be. And I think it's worth noting that it's the jury's out. We just don't know how that'll actually play out on the ground.
I think all that's right, particularly with what Misty was saying. I think that Helene is right when she says that an Iran deal could be the legacy, although it's far from clear. I mean, I think they'll probably get something, whether that's going to be enough to stave off Israel and the consequences of that. I'm really not sure, but I do think, unfortunately, a lot of the legacy of President Obama is that he'll be dogged by these foreign policy crises that we're going to see till the end, which is the ISIS. Are we going to really lose Iraq in a major way, or will he need to? Will Iraq once again become Obama's war? We're leaving with a Cold War with Russia that was worse than when we came in. I mean, one bright spot is Burma. The administration re-engaged Burma, lifted the sanctions. Things aren't 100% good, but they're going in the right direction. I think a lot of, unfortunately, the president's foreign policy pledges in the campaign to engage allies, to engage enemies like Cuba, like Iran, like North Korea. Burma was a bright spot. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be materializing. And the pivot to Asia, I think because of all of these other foreign policy crises, the administration hasn't been able to put as much emphasis on the Asia question as it wanted to.
Okay.
Thank you all very much.
I'm used to the price. So what an incredible program. We did hit lots of hot spots. Maybe we didn't get to everyone, but they'll have to come back again soon because they were also really, really fantastic. So I want to thank Elizabeth first for doing a great job as moderator, for her excellent questions. Want to thank the audience for your great questions. So Elise, Helene, Missy, and Margaret, from listening to you, we all have gotten a lot smarter, and definitely we hope to have you back soon. So on behalf of the group, if you could just step forward, because we're going to give you a little certificate of appreciation. And please accept this award for being a role model for the next generation of women covering foreign affairs and national security. You can open them. Signed by
the president, and the board chair. Thank you all for coming. This concludes today's lunch. It was wonderful to see you. We hope to see you in January. And if all WFPG board members could please come forward for the board photo. Please stay there. This was great.